Their counterparts in the House, and Mr. Kelly is conducting the Rules Committee session next door. What I'd like to do is go through the bills and put them in proper order, and it will hopefully facilitate the committee process when we have a quorum. Mr. Cotton, the first bill we're dealing with today is House Bill 321, of which you are the prime sponsor. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just give me for 1 second, Mr. Cotton. The Secretary, please record the meeting as though we had a quorum, so if this needs a reference. Excuse me, Mr. Cotton. And we are on teleconference also.
Who's on the other end? Chairman, House Bill 321 was introduced last year and has gone through several different changes. The original proposals would have cost a lot of money, would have involved state condemning property and then purchasing it and then selling it back. And we finally moved from that position to what you have in front of you now, the House Finance Committee version that was amended on the House floor, does two things. And I think I'm going to have to go back and address a little bit of history here, but there's a couple of land orders that are quite old that granted property owners the right to acquire ownership of the so-called highway lots. And I believe that was in 1958, PL 1613 changed the... I need to get some help from the Hamilton DOT here, but it changed a reservation to a withdrawal. Do I have that right, or is it backwards? Changed a withdrawal to a reservation. Anyway, the result was that a person now owning a piece of property along the Old Glen Highway, for instance, in many cases has a strip of land between his home or his lot and the highway that may end up being owned by someone else, the original entryman. BLM has proposed to give that strip of land or that piece of highway lot back to the original entryman. And most people feel that even though this would still be a highway, it would be retained as a highway easement by the Department of Transportation should they need it. But when a person purchased the lot, they expected that they were getting the highway lot as well. In fact, many of the title policies indicated that was the case. What we propose here is two things. Number one, would have helped to the title.
This baseline, please.
Of course, the person who owns the real lot, not the highway lot, would be able to claim adverse possession against the time that that person held their
total
title.
I can help. Who is the original entryman?
Original property owner for a total set of government.
This bill would increase the total.
Yes, well, in many cases, it's grown the property at the time of the
additional two members would be public members.
In many cases,
public members pointed now by the legislature.
So what happened in many cases, that original entryman
away from the criticism that the legislature
first buying a lot assumed that his front yard was also part of the
property.
But as it turns out, now BLM is going to go and deed that highway lot not to the person who owns the property, but to the original entryman, causing a pretty confusing, in some cases, pretty onerous situation, whereas the person may own a lot and a 20-foot strip between his property and the highway is owned by someone else.
Proposed system.
So again, we propose that the current landowner would be able to exercise the adverse possession law
do the work against another person who's been removed by the advisory committee.
Even though the actual land is still owned by BLM, they have claimed that the original entry
against
the member
would be
so
handled
that person
by
owned that lot for 7 years, he would have a body that
the
member adverse possession.
With some
that's the first
violation.
Second section of the bill has public presumption.
So an even
and we propose that it should be presumed that when the new owner or the current owner purchased the property, he also purchased the highway lot. Unless there was
the conveyance did not include an interest in the land. The bill before you.
There may have been some cases where the person selling the land is going to try to keep the highway lot.
False accusation.
But the
felony in the original bill,
there's
felony
shows that the
penalty for someone who brings a
title someone else.
False accusation against a member of the House or Senate, that the penalty has been soundly criticized as being overreaction, probably or could act as a deterrent.
Whoever was the original
legitimate complaint. It's not condoning false accusations, but intimidating people perhaps by various
title,
severe penalty for bringing any charges, including legitimate charges, before the ethics
committee.
This would reduce that to misdemeanor. I think that strikes the balance between protecting members, obviously.
Let me just try to clear that point. I'm going to read this here. What happened was that
versus
the Bureau of Land Management suggests that even though they held title,
from
person or the original entrant
might
have
equitable title. It's interesting when we search the statutes in the United States,
claim adverse possession, could not claim against the federal government.
Laws, there was only one state,
but he could claim it against that other person, since that other
specifically addressing false accusation, and that is the state of Maine, and they have a
misdemeanor. Here's Congress intended to release lands to be granted to owners of adjoining lands, and then when
the
original released lands sold their adjoining lands,
the
fellows, they intended to pay their rights to the released lands along with the adjoining.
Two starts on page one. This is a little difficult to read on the surface because you have to read it in conjunction with the definition section in 11, but it's readily explained. The original bill, I think, by the testimony and the comments of those that served on the conference committee, including Senator Kelly, I know, had assumed that all legislative employees, personal staff, committee staff, as well as agency staff like House Research, all employees range 18 to 12 would be covered by the provisions of the Act. Since the passage, our attorneys have told us that a strict reading of the way that the words came out in the final product, that only agency staff range 18 to 12, so that now, for example, the only staff required to file close economic association disclosures in
the
record are House Research, the Ombudsman's Office,
but
and other formal agencies. Our personal staff,
many
staff, do not have to file if they are not required. What this bill in this particular section would do is to clarify that all legislative staff, regardless of who may be paying them or which particular element of the payroll they may be on,
so
if they're range 18 or above, they would be covered.
Remain,
and this was viewed as not only an attempt at the original act, but also a fair and equitable way of handling staff.
So on your map there, you can see that the center line it runs down.
The next item is contained in section 4 of the bill.
For the extra highway, and then after
this is a minor provision. In the original bill, close economic associations were
thin strip
between
where the highway
legislators and various officials
and
lobbyists
adjoining landowners
were required, with one curious exception. They're required for all lobbyists, comma, unless the lobbyists.
In section 2 of the bill, there's the presumption that
exception
that
not
the land is conveyed to the center line after PLO 1613. Why is that?
There seems to be no apparent reason for
well,
this.
That's what the
what this bill would
that's
do
what
PLO
1613 did.
Regarding all lobbyists in general, which a lot of legislation would have
PLO, previously it was not in the center line in PLO.
Previously it had been a withdrawal of the entire
300. It was just to
PLO 1613 retained it as an easement.
An easement, but giving title to the land, but creating an easement upon the land.
Right.
Next section is 3,
particularly
4, 5,
affects
6.
Affects people in two areas. In fact, I want to make sure I state on the record that I am potentially affected by this.
The last 2 years, I think,
less than 10% interest in a piece of property that might be affected by this.
Journal for the first of the days.
Thank you for noting the record.
Close economic associations and
I'll tell you who started this was the guy that preceded me in
the first 3 or 4 days. This was particularly the first session of the legislature when people
represented Lisco.
All
one
of this,
the people who's the front yard has a question here, so also
that's
how it first came out. There's a lot of other people that brought it to my attention before I realized that I might be involved.
Fifth day of the session.
So the this is legislative. Getting questions we've been hearing in the bill, and the Adams Bill
understanding
the
law
of forum,
which I hope we'll
get to see what they disclose. I knew you had a committee meeting, that was no problem. It was my intent to go on.
I'm somewhat aware it's not just a problem. I'm not going to get a copy. There's another provision related to when loans, if there's to be specified,
the demonstration to give us no
satisfying
follow-up.
Thank you.
This would make it a time certain.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bob. Next, I'd like to take up.
And then last.
Bill 218 by Mr. Cordero. Please join us.
Provisions.
This is natural understanding of conduct of legislators and legislative employees. Otherwise, you might have to add the member. You have the floor.
They are not covered by the insurance sworn in. But we felt that it would be very beneficial
if you practice the
summary of some of the available service of the changes that have been
made in prior committees. The bill disclosed this started out last year to correct a couple of major problems in the original 1904 ethics act, particularly the composition of the legislative ethics committee. Now, under this bill, requires instead of one public member, which would still would not be three public members, rather than being appointed by the respective bodies or by the legislature, would be subject to appointment by the Supreme Court of Justice.
Section 9.
In addition, another
word change in the original bill,
it was a provision of the original ethics bill was
required for
penalty ethics making it a felon. The bill would require to reduce that to a misdemeanor so as not to be intimidating people who might want to make valid matter claims.
We don't have any legislators informal.
We've gone through all last year and so
always
striking it, which I said this year. Went through a lot of the advisory.
We continue to print all decisions and opinions and
comment on
booklets twice.
And in that process, there were a number of glitches,
Mr. Chairman,
oversight, contradictions
that's
have come up
in
the original plans that we went through last year to pick up some of them, notably who the legislators that have
four specific amendments that have largely
come up. Do I address that by including making sure that all legislative employees of range 18 or above were included, not just legislative agency employees?
The committee will give advisory to him. Who's the execution?
Legal people.
The result decision on whether or not complies with advisory committee still rests with
several
the
other problem that we found
the individual legislative
committee. It is not the advisory committee not binding on the legislation.
What that means, what has happened in practice,
is that everyone who legislators should do advisory would also have a following
problem on
said, no, you don't need to do anything.
What types of municipal officials
or we said, yes,
we have a short mechanism for the association, and are we required to disclose?
It's,
I brought
it's
several of those amendments to the.
So now we have two bodies that are they're putting demands on the legislature.
We've
got the APOC, we've got the advisory committee.
Well, the only thing good about the divided bill about clarifying is that we don't act unless
legislative employees and to
so
clarify.
We don't. We would have to have a formal request in writing from a legislator who says, should I disclose my financial dealings with this law on the basis of this information? And then we would need.
But APOC requires that.
Officials, well,
such as
no, APOC wouldn't require some
under disclosure.
Clearly excluded.
For your April financial disclosure,
you
might include those substantive things, but we're talking
the
here about having to disclose
the
journal as a post-economic situation.
Correct. Drafting your ambiguity. I personally was not happy with the way the drafting people drafted the State Affairs Amendment regarding public.
I believe that
Senator Kelly, for your information,
public official has to disclose membership on the board of directors.
Changes are made that the table or can substitute, and it basically
or inserts certain property.
On
but you don't have to list the other members of the board of directors. You don't have to list
that bill and inserting
all the members of the partnership.
That states,
so a big difference.
Make it clear
that about the same thing.
Like official, we're talking
department
about,
house. I have to list every year
not an appointed
all of the people that I do business with, who my partners
are. Who is required to file a financial disclosure statement
in what respect?
And is not an
and the whole nine yards. So
that's
I would take exception to that because
that
I don't think that's quite correct. And I have to do that for APOC under my disclosure statement.
Mr. Chairman, I'll list another example. I asked for an advisory opinion last year.
What you
agree. My actions with respect to voting on the budget,
for
an item that might or might not benefit my wife, who is employed by some agency. I want to know whether I vote
language was
or whether I have to get up and make a public statement.
Employees of legislators who would like to make my 21, if they had a close economic association with a legislator, they were required to file a close economic association. But the same legislator who had a close economic association with a staff member or legislative employee did not have to, and it was
That's not a binding response, but someone else could file
granted a
something about you, and they would open it up to turn that same complaint over to APOC, and APOC could come back in and start and investigate it all over again.
I don't think APOC would have any jurisdiction over my actions as a legislator.
And people who are employed by the legislature, they have a mutually
closed action as a legislator is exactly what APOC is all about. I do believe there is some conflict in this Senator on this because I've had that particular experience. Now either, well, of course, I've never been in front of the ethics board of the legislature, or because it's been too, you know, you've got to do some real, real bad things in order to do that.
No. Mr. Chairman.
It isn't?
No. This is not a disciplinary action that is being talked about. This is an advice to the legislature as to how high
do we all be paid
in a certain circumstance.
Suppose that would be in conflict with some other situation. Is it possible?
Well, APOC regulations have nothing to do with my voting.
Asking to be excused from voting. Requests for advisory opinions that deal with what a close economic association is. I think now in
you still have the right to stand up as to stand
because of conflict.
That's what I mean. So I asked them for advice.
One that you're well familiar with, and another one with similar personal experience. Yeah. The second one after that one is where I think people in Boston moves positively towards removing very superficial peripheral types of residents, close economic association. And I think the hope of the committee is that as we gain experience, as we get cases, we will further define through the cases of the advisory panels what is a close economic association
every year.
And I feel positively moving towards that. The original drafters of the act in the Joe World, who was lobbying very difficult,
isn't that peculiar? They insisted that I do, and they don't, and not you.
Through the,
and I have to list my partners on these things. They like to, we are providing guidance now. That answers a lot of questions there, doesn't it?
And they mean with my partners too.
Yeah,
so you're familiar with the
but some do and some don't. Okay, one other question. It said on line 1, on line 29, page 1, each February 1, it must be delivered to
support and,
to deliver a listing of all outstanding persons in this chapter applies except for those described in A. Yet it says the list should be published in the supplemental journal before February the 5th of each year. And yet throughout it we have after the 5th date of the legislature. Isn't that rather short from the first, from 1 to 5 days to put it in the journal? Particularly when we're isn't that a little fast?
Well, right now we're having to disclose the close economic association.
We'll put that aside. There's several bills that I have to the bill is about today. Those bills don't have any further referrals work. From a
practical matter, the loans list every day from now on. Dates are ready to settle in mind.
Most people are
Thank you.
We'll have to fill aside waiting for a quorum.
They have to disclose with the state which ones they don't.
The question but the committee staff does Mr. Cotton's bill further.
Now this year they came in the first week of January. I didn't feel that it was even if they would come in February 1st.
Let's like take up the House bill
changes in
438
at it and say, gee, boy, now
all the advisories
I did feel that 5 days would
be 438. There will be another bill for that.
Yeah, Representative Davis.
This, the February 5th date just refers to the...
We will all do, we'll do 1.5 list, and then we'll get back to that.
It's not the disclosure. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You do not have, you wouldn't have to follow it like that. That's just when we physically...
Linda, this is Pat Rhodey. Are you on the other end of the line?
This is just for the legislature.
Yes, I am.
This bill has nothing to do with the administration.
Reading the bill as we're talking.
Is there anything going about that?
And I understand you have a position from the Attorney General's office. Please proceed.
Thank you. Just a little background on this act. Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act is modeled after Section 5A1 of the FTC Act. The FTC Act, as does the last Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act, prohibits unfair and deceptive acts or practices and unfair methods of competition in the marketplace. The FTC Act was passed in 1914 and it has been over 70 years of court interpretation of the act. But this is very significant because our act provides that due weight and consideration will be given interpretation of the FTC Act. All 50 states have statutes prohibiting unfair and deceptive acts or practices in trade commerce. The basic purpose of the act is to promote honesty in the marketplace and to protect honest businesses from the unfair competition of those transacting business and lawsuits. The act gives the Attorney General investigative powers and allows the Attorney General to seek civil penalties, injunctive relief, and restitution to consumers in Superior Court. There are no criminal penalties for violations of the act. The Consumer Protection Center receives nearly 3,000 written consumer complaints a year, but we only file 10 to 20 lawsuits a year because most of the problems are resolved on a voluntary basis. Since the mid-1970s, the Attorney General Consumer Protection Center has accumulated experience in enforcing the act, which prompted the suggestions to the legislature for amending the act. This bill, as it currently is in its current committee substitute, would make three major changes to the act. First, it would make clear that the act protects businesses as well as consumers when businesses are acting as consumers. Many frauds are directed at small businesses to reduce purchases of office supplies, equipment, advertising, specialties, directories, etc. House Bill 125 would make it clear that if a business is not purchasing for retail, but rather acting as a consumer, they would be protected by the Act. Changes in Section 531 of the Act would also clarify that a business has the right to file a private cause of action for violations of the Act. Specifically, the Act adds definition of trade and commerce, which clarifies that real property consumer transactions are important to protect the Act. And thirdly, the exemption provisions in the Act are clarified. And then there's some general technical cleanup. I provided the committee with section by section analysis of whatever you would like from me to do at this point, rather than see section by section.
I don't think that will be necessary, Linda. I'm familiar with this section of statute, having dealt with bills in this area before. I think that we don't have a full committee here, and perhaps the best thing, rather than go through it section by section, is provide me the kind of background that you are providing me.
Until I got to the last phrase of the definition.
To point out that one of the major provisions in the Act is already stated, it's actually found in the definition section, and that is the change in definition of trade or commerce. Right now, the statute law is very unclear whether or not this Act applies to consumer real property transactions. It does not apply clearly as the legislature currently stands. In purchase of raw land that is unimproved land. It does apply, arguably, in the purchase of improved real property that would be single-family homes and condominiums. But this causes them a lot of effort whenever we have complaints by consumers and complaining against the builders, contractors, the builder condominiums, or their single-family homes. There's always question raised as to whether we have jurisdiction of this issue. clearly, if this legislation were adopted, we would have jurisdiction over what is the major
I don't think you follow. The problem comes in on the first page when
the
first appear.
Over the years, we have many businesses in Colorado complaining about the unfair practices of their competitors. Perhaps their advertising is false or fraudulent, and they want us to be aware of them. Very often, we stop the advertising efforts. And if the competitors can perform their aspect, the business person who is harmed by that fraudulent advertising to the competitor is not made whole because they not, we don't seek damages on behalf of that business person who was harmed by that competitor. That would make it clear that while the AG doesn't want to seek those kind of damages on behalf of business people, that there would have a cause to action against the competitor who violated the act. Of course, the business person would have to prove their damages and be able to prove
that this
chapter
does not apply to the first page.
Loss of profit, whatever. But at least they would have that.
An employee of a public employee of a legislator.
We interrupted him with questions. Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Well, you want to take care of this one first while we're here. Does anyone want to make an amendment to this?
Why don't you just take it back to the house and clean it up over there?
I guess I would move that that we'd add another non-appliance somewhere on 18. On 18 that does not apply to a private employer, public, a private employer or legislator or something like that. And that's before the legislature. It kind of spells it out. And I think it should be because it's, if we're interpreting it this way, we can interpret how many other words. What would you want to do? You want to put in number one in the number?
We're going to make it a new four.
Make it a new four? All right. You want to give me language? This does not apply to a person.
The private employee of the legislature.
Who is privately employed by the legislator. Or an agency.
And does not perform.
And does not perform legislative duties. Person who is privately.
Who is performing legislative duties?
Or your attorney?
Is this language all right? A person who is privately employed by a legislator and does not perform legislative duties? Does that cover it? So move.
Say that again.
A person who is privately employed by a legislator and does not perform legislative duties.
Yes.
It does not apply to it. An objection. Here you go. That will be item four.
Mr.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
I would move that page 1, lines 14 to 16, despite the language F. Beginning with comma,
after legislature,
to the period, or to the period, and substitute, and as employee of the legislative branch.
Right now,
Mr. Chairman, wait a minute. Legislative branch. So we read this chapter applies to a member of the legislature and employer, employee of the legislative branch. And strike and to a permanent or temporary. No, no. and strike all the way down to line 16, period, after legislature.
Mr. Chairman, and then... And this change would be made in several other places. Is that correct? Is that up here again?
Wait a minute, okay, you moved on adding objections to that.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
And then, Mr. Chairman, that the definition on page 5, subsection 2, be stricken and in lieu thereof.
Thank you for your comment, and...
To be a definition of employee of the legislative branch means.
Very well, I have no questions against...
The definition of an employee of the legislative branch.
Do you need me to stand by?
No, I don't believe that's necessary. I'm not sure when the other members of the committee would be here, to be honest with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
In this chapter, person employed by the legislature.
Okay, the employee of the legislative branch means.
Yeah.
A person who is employed by an individual legislator
to perform legislative duties.
Or by a legislative body.
438. Representative Davis.
Including an agency of the legislature.
Senator, would you want to insert a committee there, including a committee or an agency?
Including a committee.
In an agency or an agency.
Get closer. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
An agency of the legislature established in there. It's 2420, whose views include assistance.
Changes to the Alaska Historic Preservation Act.
Okay, we want to put that in a little more context.
Okay, I shall read it again. Mr. Chairman, so it would be in this chapter 2. Employee of the legislative branch means a person who is employed by an individual legislator or by a legislative body, including a legislative committee or an agency of the legislature established in the AS 2420. Is that you with your approval? Is there any objections to the motion? Would you comment?
The reason why this, I became aware of this,
objections, very good, so ordered. Now, I have a question, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, on page 4, with new language, lines 14 and 15, what is the reason for that? I don't necessarily object, I just don't know what the reason is.
That language did not appear in the original bill that was added by the House Judiciary Committee. The feeling there was that a former member would add valuable experience, a certain amount of insight to problems and complaints that might be facing the legislature.
Well, if I may, ask a question here. Are we not trying to establish ethics for legislators? And therefore, why should we have an ex-legislator on it? Would that not give the same perception that we've got a fox in the hen coop, so to speak?
Mr. Chairman, I personally would agree with that. Detracts significantly from the bill, but I personally feel it doesn't help the overall objective that we're trying to achieve. And I personally have no problem with that.
Was
there a 4 or 500 million dollar
inquiry?
I would leave that we spelled out
slide 14.
Any objections?
It's fraught with peril.
Right, hearing none, so ordered.
I might add for aircraft that also removes the necessity for one of my proposed amendments.
You want to get to your amendments now?
There's some aircraft that are still back out in the bush.
Line 1, page 1, following line 27.
This amendment, you should have before you a summary sheet entitled Proposed Amendments to CS 218. Amendment number one is clearly a policy call. It's a major issue, I believe. We have dealt with it on the Ethics Committee once. The court in Fairbanks has tangentially dealt with this problem. In a nutshell, the original act cites a particular type of competitive bid that is permissible for legislators to engage in state contracts with. In other words, under 3705, there's a hard dollar type bid arrangement or a low dollar bidding on any kind of state construction project that we as legislators, we own a construction company, under the existing act, we were entitled to bid on that, whereby a low bid was chosen and it was a purely competitive situation. We've had situations, two particular legislators have companies which engage their business depends to some part on contracts with the state. These particular contracts are RFP type contracts. They do not fall strictly under 3705-230. Even though the procedures, they are competitive and their competitive procedures are very similar, RFP or professional service competitive contracts occur in another statute, 3698. So if you had a consulting firm and bidding on professional services for the state, it would be competitive, but in professional service RFP type contracting, there is an element of subjectivity. There's a group of state officials that meet to go through the proposals, and they give certain points for experience and for creativity or whatever for a proposal. It's not a hard dollar or strictly low dollar award. The Ethics Committee, published opinion on an advisory committee, 84-6, ruled that the legislature, in their belief, intended that all types of competitively awarded contracts, including professional services, should be permissible under the assumption that we're basically, or should be, a citizen legislature, that people have business interests, that because of the way the state of Alaska is intricately involved in the elements of our economy, that it may be unavoidable to not be involved in some type of contract, and it may be necessary for the livelihood.
Under the existing law to get permits.
Be that as it may, so clearly in the bill is an ambiguity as to whether or not legislators are to be permitted to participate in professional service RFP type competitive contracts. Regardless of how you feel about it, some change needs to be made in the law to clarify what types of competitive contracts legislators are going to be permitted to deal with. There's two basic choices. If you feel that legislators or their companies should only be involved in hard dollar or low dollar type contracting, like a construction contract, then rather than this citation, we should say by competitive sealed bid. And I think in the packet there's two memos from the Department of Administration clarifying what that means, and they've suggested if that's what we mean, to limit it only to these low dollar type contracts, we should use the words by competitive sealed bid. If it's our intention to allow legislators or their companies to participate in competitive RFP type processes involving professional services, then we need to again remove that citation and say by competitive sealed bid or competitive sealed proposal. This is the only way to do this is to get it head on and not make it ambiguous or unclear as to how it now exists.
Senator Fisher.
I would move that the committee adopt the amendment as proposed in amendment number one to page 1, line 27, including the language, additional language, by competitive sealed bid.
Could be a problem. Could mean we have a problem.
Note that several of them,
Senator, I'd be hard pressed to argue that point. We have made allowances, for the ethics committee as well as the court has said, in essence, through rather tortured reasoning because of this ambiguity, that it was felt that legislators could participate in professional service competitive contracts.
I think legislature has asked for money on occasion.
I presented it in the most restrictive way here. I think it's valid to go the other way, to specifically allow professional service contracts.
Well, I'm not a big fan of legislative contracts in the state, but we very carefully crafted that language to take in the ability of people to be able to make money and raise a family. The situation we're facing now is the legislature is in fact going to repeal it. We're probably going to turn it over to a commission of public members to determine what, in their mind, is going to be what's worth 4 months of your work. You know, you're going to have to be able to be employable outside the legislature, or you're not going to be able to survive in Alaska. And we've got to be pretty careful about just how tightly we're going to tie the 60 members, whoever they may be, long after we're done. There's still going to be people serving in Alaska legislature. We have one case, for example, where we have a legislator that flies the air taxi service in the bush and picks up a short lunch for fishing dinner. And that was discussed in the last war. And under the existing language, that person can
other states have a similar provision in their laws.
But I would submit that I had a competitive seal bid.
The existing statute, this 3705-230 exception, only on its face strictly applies to hard dollar or low dollar type contract and not to professional service or RFP contract.
So, then I don't understand, how could the ethics committee say, no, it's not restricted, how come the court says it's restricted?
There are three exceptions to the provision. The last of them is, the last exception is, if it's a standardized contract, generally available to the public at large, the ethics committee in its decision said that an RFP contract is a, quote, standardized contract.
Come up here and do the dig, or someone wants to come up here and do the dig and sell in Chicago art fair that...
As just one legislator reading this statute, I disagree with that reason. The court did agree with it. I don't think that's the end of our problem.
RFP is not a standardized contract.
There's another thing.
The referral of finance, so we do have
it's far from settled.
I hear that. There are several bills that I told you earlier that I had already filed, but I was mistaken because the bill doesn't for the referral of finance.
But I don't understand what we're going to do. Let's give them
an opportunity, a fair opportunity to be heard. It has to go on. So
Chairman,
we'll
just
the finance committee.
If I were to put into statute to affect which you would still remove the under AS 3705-230, and you would substitute by competitive sealed bid. Or
next, I'd take a House Bill 237,
filling out exactly
an aggravating protection reform
situations that you have permitted.
Mr. Humphreys,
this language appears as the exception to an otherwise ban on all state contracting legislators. So we're looking at
the exception. So the record, my name is Ken Humphreys, I'm director of the Division of
Government. Both sealed bids and
House Bill 237, by way of a very brief introduction. That you have before you, I guess, could be characterized as a potential reform bill.
Right. Otherwise, no contract. That it's probably spelled out better than I've described it in this letter from Bob Link or Robert Link on February 20th. contracts.
And how does that?
Or even the administration would let bids for
we need 500,000 pencils, and people come in for a low bid on pencils. It does not include, in, strictly in that statute, professional service. The professional services come strictly with AS 3698. The procedures are very similar in terms of the protections of the process itself, the process by which you go to these, through these steps of competitive procedures are very similar.
Well, let's see if I can understand this. Under 3705230, all bids would be competitive sealed bids. But everything that falls under 3705230 is not a competitive bid, sealed bid?
Correct. There are competitive sealed proposals, the RFP-type process for consulting that involve a little more subjectivity, are not included.
I rule my objection. I was just about to start arguing.
No, it's the balance of that particular Section 3 amendment to the approved committee. We don't want that. Would move we adopt it. Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman, amendment number 2 again stems from a real advisory opinion case that the Ethics Committee had before it. Legislators and others covered by the act are required to file close economic associations if they have financial dealings with lobbyists, other legislators, and public officials, and then the words are public officials who, public official in another branch, if the public official is required to file financial disclosure. We had a case where a legislator asked us if they needed to file a close economic association with an elected municipal official. Well, when we got to looking at it, some members know this case intimately. An elected municipal official is indeed one required under state law to file a public disclosure, but they are not, in the common sense, considered in another branch. We normally think of a branch as being an executive, judicial, legislative. So we rule that a disclosure was indeed required because we felt the legislature intended that the disclosure should be made with all public officials who had to file financial disclosures, not exclude those that just because they were in another branch.
Mr. Chairman, I move the page 2, lines 21, 23 amendment.
Hang on just a second.
Object.
Do we make, are we for, do legislative employees under the terms of your bill, over the arrangement 18, do they have to file financial disclosure statements?
Yes, they do. What's happened to date, because we haven't included so many.
They will have to file under the terms of your bill, correct?
All of them under the terms would have to file above the range 18 if they had close economic associations.
Well,
then would they also be considered a public official who is required to file a financial disclosure statement under 950?
No, they don't come under this particular subsection, but they do come under one that's right above that. It says, that's the one we just amended, that we just talked about. That's another listing. It's lobbyists, other legislators, then we'd have, as amended now, all staff, public officials.
Why range 8, step A, range 18?
It was fairly, it was an arbitrary cutoff, but it was felt that staff above that had
policy decisions.
Policy decisions.
It's too bad that the step, it's too bad that the range 10 doesn't also qualify for that with the legislative pay raises that we're going back to. Thought I'd get that in just for the hell of it. It's been moved to adopt.
So this just opens it up. I don't know, Pat. This means that us as individuals have to file all of this garbage if, in fact, we have any kind of relationship with anybody out there that has to file a financial statement.
Well, under the existing law, we
like to do this. How many financial statements are there on file at APFC? How many financial statements are there on file at APFC? Does anybody know?
I don't have the answer to that, but in essence, it would be all elected officials plus
at every level, school boards, local city council, all municipal officials. Why don't we hold off on this one and check and see how many people we're talking about with APLC?
Would this also, and the legislator himself would have to comply with that too?
Yes.
Because
we do that now.
He wouldn't have to because he'd be below a step, a range 18.
Oh.
Is that true?
That wouldn't be true because we, in the amendment that we just made, we said a member of the legislature, comma, staff above the range. So
frankly, I'm not sure. I was close to this bill when it passed. I was on all the committees. I think you two were. Weren't you two, Victor? I don't remember us, discussing in length whether or not we should file a disclosure with a local official, a school board member, something like this. I think we certainly thought somebody in the executive branch, somebody in the judicial branch, but I'm not convinced. Do we want to go to that level?
Mr. Chairman, I was very conscious of that because my wife was then an elected local official who had to file a financial disclosure statement.
We excluded you in another section.
And I always assumed that it was covered.
Let me check with APLC.
Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw my motion for time.
Okay, let's go to the next one, line 4, page 15.
This one has been made moot by your deletion of the legislator, the former legislator on the ethics committee.
Okay, how about page 4, line 15?
Okay, this would be the last amendment. This stems from a very real situation that we faced on the ethics committee. Just before the beginning of the 14th legislature, the ethics committee met to discuss an advisory opinion brought by a member of that committee. Under the Ethics Act, he correctly disqualified himself from the discussion. He didn't vote, and the committee went ahead and met. But the Ethics Act also says that when a member has to disqualify himself, that the Speaker or the President will replace him with another member that has to be confirmed by the body, by two-thirds vote. Well, during the interim, it's impossible to get the confirmation. So all this amendment does is set up a situation, set up the procedure that would happen if in an interim situation, a member of the Ethics Committee had to be disqualified or disqualified himself, the Speaker or the President could just appoint a temporary member for just that proceeding, and it would be subject to a majority concurrence by the members of the committee. But then that would be a way of physically handling that situation in the interim where you can't go back to the full body and get a two-thirds confirmation. Otherwise, it would, during the session, work just as it is now.
Mr. Chairman, just to get things going, I move that the committee adopt the proposed amendment to page 4, following line 15, insert as shown in the section 10.
Object for the purposes of just one question. The legislature is not in session now. Scenario. A member has been disqualified. Presiding officer of the House, like let's say the Senate or the House, the Speaker of the House, is going to appoint another member from that House with the concurrence of a majority vote of the subcommittee. That subcommittee being
just the Senate members or just the House members.
That act as a member. Now, what kind of roll call would this be? Could this be done by phone, or would you have to pull them all together, or what? How would this be accomplished?
I would assume it would be at the meeting that they would be.
They would have to call a special meeting of the House.
No, not of the House, just of the of those members on the Ethics
Committee. On the Ethics Committee.
Yeah. But they would probably be meeting because they'd be discussing a particular case that the member would have to be disqualified from. So they would be meeting around the table when that would happen.
Mr. Chairman, since we may be building legislative history here, I think that it would be perfectly appropriate that in this particular situation, concurrence could be by telephone, by letter, or just by any form, so long as it is formally recorded at some point in the proceedings of the Ethics Committee. Because
the presiding officer may wish to check with the two members before the substitute member from a particular house is asked to come to a meeting. So I think a telephonic other type of communication should be appropriate.
I would think by letter, because we'd have a track on it. We'd have a written word rather than just a phone call. Something that could be shown to the committees and or to the House, et cetera, when we convene again for confirmation of that.
I think that would be desirable. I would assume the Speaker would especially have that in writing where he made an appointment.
With the concurrence of a written majority vote of the subcommittee on page on that amendment, next to the last sentence. Or where would you want to add? It should be a written communication.
Mr. Chairman, on the other hand, it might be done in committee where it's done by voice vote. So,
but it would be recorded. You should have it recorded or something. Just picking up the phone and saying, how do you go with this? And the guy says, fine. And you call Ben, and Ben says, well, name Joe Blow to it. There's no record of it or anything. I think we've got to establish that. Because it will come up before the House again, and there should be something.
Mr. Chairman, how about doing it this way? With a recorded concurrence of the votes.
Right. Recorded. Add the word recorded after the word with the. So in context, it'll read with the recorded concurrence of the majority, etc. Then move that we adopt that particular amendment under Section 10, and I'll remove my objections. Sorry.
Let's get back to the amendment on the first page again. Another branch amendment. As I understand it, then I would have to, or a legislator would have to disclose the formation or maintenance of a close economic association involving a substantial financial matter with, by adding that language, virtually every official throughout the state, school board, city council, assembly person. Anybody that has to file, commissioners, anybody that has to file, I mean part-time commissioners, not departmental heads, financial disclosure statement. Does that mean that if I buy a car from Jane Anbin, she was still on, for $500, that I've got?
No, it's under $1,000, isn't it?
That would just be the contract.
Yeah, okay.
What is a substantial financial matter?
Substantial
defined?
Financial, it's not defined, and we've wrestled with that in several instances, which you may be familiar with, but probably your example would be true. I think it's important to know that even under the existing, the way, even a strict interpretation of the way it's written now, you would still have to do it for all executive branch people. That would include commission people, board members. That would be. So if you were wanting to exclude non-judicial, executive, legislative people, you would have to say, you'd want to spell that out in the definition.
Exactly.
Of
what bothers me is that I don't want to have to think about whether somebody has to file an APOC, conflict of interest statement, before I do business with them or buy something from them or buy a home or buy a car. Am I being unreasonable?
Or a rifle? Or anything? Is there any objection? I don't think you're being unreasonable at all.
You'd still have this substantial financial interest criteria that would hopefully exclude.
What would be substantial? How do you define substantial? There's got to be an amount.
That's at the whim of the ethics committee.
That's right.
There is no definition, and it has been a subject of debate.
About over $25,000.
This is what category you fall. Me, it'd be 200.
People got it, and some people don't.
Mr. Chairman, a suggestion. Let us get a committee substitute prepared, including all the changes we've made, and have language drafted for this particular section that would exclude local government people
local government officials who file AS-3950 statements.
I don't have any trouble.
Just to look at, just so we can see it then.
I don't have any trouble with the judicial branch, the executive branch, anything of that nature.
And now, see that that's drawn up, would you please? All right, we will hold the bill until we, and then we'll have committee substitute, etc. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll bring this up again.
A question on your amendment number one. Was that debated on the floor? Will there be trouble having concurrent vote on that in the House?
That was not debated on the floor because it wasn't flagged as an ambiguity. I thought when we took the bill early last session. For example, the court case was, I think, in later last year, and it's been something that's really come to light after that.
Do you foresee anything in the bill that might preclude the House from concurring our amendment after this point?
I don't see anything.
Thank you, Representative Shaw, for your attention. The next bill is the Senate Bill number 391. The Rules Committee requests the governor. Is there someone to speak for that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my name is Randall Burns. I'm with the Department of Law.
I'm Ron Lawrence, I'm Deputy Attorney General with the Department of Law.
And we're here to talk about Senate Bill 391. I don't know how you want to go about this, but what we thought we could do is, since this is an entirely new bill and creates a new chapter, we thought perhaps the thing to do, with, particularly your time is limited, I believe, maybe we could just do an overview today of its content, and then if you want to go section by section, we could do that another time, perhaps. Is that okay with you?
Proceed.
Okay. This originally was the Senate Special Committee on Procurement and Ethics and was a portion of that charge after the impeachment proceedings last summer. That committee dealt primarily, however, with the procurement code and got into ethics towards the end of the summer and didn't have enough time to really focus on the ethics legislation as a whole. And particularly since Governor Sheffield wanted to draft legislation because it particularly affected the executive branch, that committee went ahead and instructed the governor to go ahead and draft the bill and introduce it. We've been working on that bill since that time then. There were a series of meetings have been held. We had one in early January, and at that meeting there were representatives from Senator Fake's staff, representatives from the Ombudsman's Office, the Legislative Affairs, Legal Services Division. We even had a political scientist from the University of to assist us in going through the first draft. There were lots of changes that were made. We then had a second meeting with a representative from each department going over the bill, and as a result of that meeting, and also an extensive meeting with Terry Kramer, who works for the Legislative Legal Services Division, came up with the draft that you have for you today. I would also like to let you know that we have been going from department to department, talking with the division directors and deputy commissioners and commissioners of each department, apprising them of the provisions of this bill, because obviously this bill, which affects only the executive branch, we want to try to, if, as much as possible, give them background into what its provisions are. The first thing this bill does do is create a new commission, the Alaska Ethics Commission. There was a considerable debate on whether or not there should be a separate commission or whether or not the authority for the ethics legislation should be given to the APOC. After debating that issue, we concluded that the APOC at this time is sufficient. It already administers three laws, that this additional burden, particularly since it covers 16,000 employees, would simply overburden that agency, and we decided that it would be preferable that a new commission be established as opposed to giving those responsibilities to the APOC. There's been some debate internally as well as about that decision, primarily because I believe the fiscal number for this bill is over $750,000.
and this is not a good time to be creating probably new entities. We went ahead, though, and persevered on establishing a separate commission because we do believe that the workload that will fall upon this agency, particularly in its first couple of years of formation, would simply, giving it to the APOC, unless it had a sufficient fiscal note, would really make that difficult to do and would basically make an ethics code non-workable if there weren't enforcement powers also. The commission that was formed has 7 members appointed by the governor subject to legislative confirmation.
Excuse me.
Sure.
Does this, what percentage of the workload on APOC would be reduced by this commission? Because I'm sure that there are other ones who would come in falling under the purview of this.
What the only thing that this does, Senator, is remove some portion of the financial disclosure requirements that are currently on executive branch, the conflict of interest statement. Those provisions that are currently on APOC, those provisions have been moved over into this bill just for the filing of financial disclosure statements. It's estimated that that's only less than 15% of the APOC's time now is spent just in receiving and auditing those statements. And
so now we would have 2 APOCs, so to speak, one for the executive branch and one for the everybody else.
Well, all this, the APOC, one of the reasons that we determined to create the new commission was that the APOC spends, as you well know, a significant portion of its time in the regulation of the campaigns, and much less significant time is spent in the area of conflicts of interest. And in order to really give the commission, the new commission, the authority it needs in terms of information about conflicts of interest, it was determined just to move, just for the executive branch, those portions over to this bill. It still leaves the APOC with, as you well know, candidates for office, legislators once they're elected, judicial branch, and all, as you were talking about earlier, many, many municipal officials who file conflict of interest statements as well. Those would still be under the purview of the APOC.
Would it not be advisable then, under consideration, to move all of the conflict of interest problems over to this particular commission in the services of them?
We considered that. Our concern was that this bill would already cover 16,000 people. If you added in addition the municipalities, that would be, God, as you well know, we don't even know what that figure is. I'm sure it's in excess of 3,000. That it would just be too burdensome for this agency. But that was something that was considered.
So let's get something straight. When we say 16,000 people, is every secretary of the executive branch going to be covered by this?
Yes,
they have to report?
No. Well, there are a number of things they do report. They do not file conflict of interest statements. But every employee of the executive branch is covered, and including the University of Alaska, the railroad, and in quasi. And,
okay, but to what extent is it going to require any work on the committees?
Oh, it would depend on employees who might have questions about some holding they may have, some interest that they have that, in view of the code that's established here, might pose a problem for them in terms of their relationship. In which case, they could ask the commission for an advisory opinion. It's not, realistically speaking, we're probably talking about maybe 5,000 people who might. But for instance, in many states where they have created ethics commissions, in the first couple of years, there have been as many as 500, 300 to 500 requests for advisories on an annual basis. So the commission itself would be real busy. It does cover public official under this new bill is defined as an individual who's at a range 26 or higher. You were talking about 18 here. But this is at range 26 only would be only those people who had to file what you now call conflict of interest statements. This would include... Excuse me?
26 is a little high.
What that basically does is get every single person who's currently filing under the APOC, and includes a few others who are not currently filing. One of the problems with the way that we find the way that the current law is written is it enumerates by name the positions, and then when the executive branch creates a new position, for instance, an assistant to the commissioner, they're not required to file because the language in the statute does not cover them. So it was deemed that if you established a range as opposed to having to come in and amend the statute every time someone of that level was a position was created, you could solve that problem. And it does cover everyone who's currently filing a few more. And then it drops out, however, division, a few division directors. So we've said not only is it range 26 or above for financial disclosure, it's also division directors, assistants to governors, and anyone that the governor wished at some point.
Do you have deputy division directors?
There are deputy, but they're not covered by this. And then the governor could also, at any time by executive order, require that additional people file financial disclosure statements. It also includes the...
We've gone through this before.
It also includes the University of Alaska, the Alaska Railroad. The Alaska Railroad, I think, has some hesitancy about being included. We have included them. Our feeling is that until the railroad becomes its goal, which of course is to become a private entity, until it is sold, it is a quasi-public corporation, and we would like everyone who is in fact in the executive branch to be required to be held to the same standard. And we did not wish to have like driving through a town, different towns with different speed limits. We felt it was legitimate that everyone be held to the same standard. But that obviously is a policy call. Like as I mentioned, it does transfer the financial disclosure requirements from the conflict of interest law into this bill. And it also creates a procedure whereby a public official or an employee, if they have a question about whether or not they are in conflict with the code of ethics, can, as your bill, as your legislative ethics does, they may ask for an advisory opinion and receive that from the commission. It also sets out procedures for filing a complaint and holding a hearing when there are allegations of a violation of the code of ethics. It does, however, also create a series of reports that everyone would have to file now. There is some controversy about this, I might tell you, within the executive branch. It would be first if they received a gift or a benefit, they would have to report that. If they could have, if their official actions, they could have benefited the giver through official action. They also must state if they have any grant, contract, lease, or loan with the department in which they work. In other words, if somehow they have managed through their private functions to receive a grant or a contract or a lease or a loan from the department which they work for, we felt it was appropriate that they disclose that to the commission. And finally, any outside state service that they might hold, we ask that that be disclosed to the commission.
Now, would that cover all employees or just...
Yes, all employees.
Well, no wonder it's going to take $650,000.
$700,000. The first year, it's $100,000 in first-time costs. After that, it's about...
I think we all know what we're getting at here. We're, for the most part, getting at the division directors and above. And every time we get a proposal, you know, everybody wants to put these 16,000 state employees under some kind of Big Brother scrutiny. You know, I don't think it's necessary to talk to a range 10 secretary and to expect her to report anything at all.
Well, it's doubtful that she would have anything to report.
What if she has an outside, what if she has a business interest in, say, a janitorial service where she's a half partner?
Uh-huh.
You know, moonlighting, single parent.
Sure.
It's hard to make it on a range 10 salary, so she works at night cleaning houses as part of J&S janitorial.
Right.
Okay, now does she have to report that?
Yes. Would not obviously preclude her from doing that. She'd just have to report it.
Well, Ms. Chairman.
Yes.
I'm also concerned about the scope, but at the same time, I would be very concerned about the grade 16 purchasing agent, a purchasing clerk who has a supply business on the side, and it might be very relevant to the performance of that person's duties.
It's difficult to draw those lines, as you well know, about who should and at which point they should and shouldn't. Our feeling is that in terms of the filing a piece of paper on a simple form that says I'm working here wouldn't take much of an employee's time. And one of the things that we talked about, our opinion is that there is out there the perception, obviously on behalf of the public, that the executive branch is sort of a hotbed of conflicts, and we don't think that's true. One of the easiest ways to combat that appearance or that notion is in fact to require, at least for a period of time, that these people perhaps file these reports, brief as they may be. It would certainly give people then an idea of what in fact is actually occurring within the executive branch as opposed to this fact and and fancy disagreements that we have now. If later on there was, you could draw a distinct line at some point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's a pretty expensive price to pay for providing a clean bill of health. Did you consider moving into this or applying this legislation gradually? In other words, taking the first 26 and above range, rolling them in, then 2 years later or a year later going down to 18 or whatever the appropriate ranges might be, and seeing to what extent that is appropriate, rather than sort of going all the way through having the tremendous burden of sort of informing everybody, educating everybody, dealing with this horrendous mass of forms that may or may not come.
Right.
Was any consideration given to a gradual approach?
I suppose there wasn't, in terms of the way that this, the effective dates of this bill are staggered. It doesn't do it in over a 2 or 3 year period. But what it does do is, it, if the bill was enacted in July of this year, it would create the commission who could hire the staff to begin an education program with the executive branch. Then in January of next year, after a period of time of that education program, people could begin requesting advice as to whether or not their particular situation may be in conflict and what they could do to cure that problem. The code itself would not take effect until July of 1987, a year after the bill was actually passed. That would give people time. We did not wish to enact legislation that would suddenly find everyone in conflict. And this would give people an opportunity then to have cured those possible conflicts before, in fact, the legislation went into effect. And that, to that extent, we gave some consideration to that, but we did not do anything in terms of staggering the coverage within the...
Mr. Chairman, my concern is, I think, Senator Kelly's, is that the kind of fiscal note that we might be faced with, I don't see one here yet, but that it may guarantee that nothing will be done this legislative session, and I think that that would be much more damaging than taking a first step, and that, and I would suggest looking at maybe you, whoever else is involved, looking at this in terms of what you can do for 300,000 or you know, something much, much more reasonable.
I think the theory is, I agree with you that probably, obviously, the area of conflicts will be in certainly above a range 10. The question is where to draw that line, and the question is, even assuming that we were to not, for instance, not cover all employees, just maybe range 18, say, or above, but still you're going to have a substantial number of people requesting. It's our opinion that that's where, in fact, the areas of the issues of the conflicts will arise, and that the budget is basically based on the assumption that we will have probably 300 requests in that area, not to mention any investigations that may occur. One of the questions we have is, if, you know, obviously, if you believe that this should not be a separate agency, but in fact should be somehow incorporated into a current entity, if that's something we can also look at other places to put it, or we can figure out a way to give it to the APLC. Our feeling was that they were simply overburdened at this point, and handling and trying to save money by handling over to them.
Well,
was
Mr.
not
Chairman,
saved.
Mr. Chairman, let me just cut that short, if
yeah.
I may. If your fiscal note has any validity whatsoever, I would assume the same fiscal note
right.
would apply to APLC, except for the per diem for the commission members. So, you know,
I agree with that.
They're overworked and underfunded already. So, you know, it wouldn't save any money except, you know, a few thousand dollars at the very most.
Right.
Well, I think my approach would be to move some of the functions from APOC into this new commission, to be honest with you, and just have APOC there strictly for campaigns, and then the rest of it can be handled by something, another entity.
Should I continue, or do you want us to, how do you like to go about this?
Well, we'll still go on for another 5 minutes.
I've got a couple of questions before.
Oh, sure.
When would the, if this bill passes this year, when would it become law? When would the appointment be made?
87.
if the bill took effect in this year, then the appointments would be made sometime in the summer after the effective date of July 1. Hopefully that the staff would be hired and then they could get the education program in line. The code itself would not take effect until following year, July 1 of 87, giving people basically a full year to try to solve any immediately obvious conflicts and cure those problems. We really were concerned that as soon as the bill passed, there would be people out there just waiting to, and as you might be sensitive to, waiting to run and file a complaint. And we didn't think that was legitimate, particularly with new legislation, so we gave that year's grace period to solve those problems.
So the boards will be set up in July of 86. So your advisory opinions on January of 87. The rules go in July of 87.
That's right. One of the...
Did you have another question?
Well, I've got a concern, you know, in that we're setting up an executive branch board of ethics, essentially appointed by the governor within the executive branch. Frankly, I'm not sure that's a proper protection. If we're going to do this, I would suspect we should have a little more independence than that.
One of the things that we're obviously sensitive to that, that was one of the reasons for making them public members and refrain from allowing only one current member of the executive branch, either as an employee or an official, to serve on the board. And the members themselves would be subject to legislative confirmation, not just simply appointed by the governor, they would be subject to your approval.
Well, then one of the bills we've had, just heard this morning, we eliminated one of the legislators from one of these, this ethics committee, so to speak, from the legislature. I don't see why that same situation couldn't apply to the executive branch. I don't think that a member of the executive branch should be a member of this particular committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have six members proposed under this bill. Previous bill, we'd have six out of nine who are legislators and three public members. Mm-hmm.
This is six.
But if we're going to get squeaky clean, and that's what this all does, perhaps that's a...
I guess our feeling was, in including the fact that only one of the seven could be a current member of the executive branch, was that at least there might be someone there, although who would have some expertise with how the executive branch functions and what's occurring within the executive branch. But only one of those could be that. And it doesn't say it has to be, it says it may be.
And it also says, Mr. Chairman, it says public official or employee, so right. It could be a local official or a legislator.
No, public official is defined as a member of the executive branch.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. So it would have to be a member of the branch.
But
there's only one, and it doesn't have to be either. It says it's a may, not a shall be. The other feeling was, and I agree with Senator Kelly's concerns about its independence, again, the executive director is hired by the commission, not by the governor's office. And that was another way to try to isolate the staff from any concern about.
Mr. Chairman, there's an interesting phrase on this very subject, page 2, line 26. A member of the commission may be removed by the governor for cause. Now, does this mean that a commissioner may be removed only for cause, or a commissioner may be removed for cause and for any other reasons
that the governor wants?
That the governor wants, or without reason?
No, it means only for cause.
It does.
Right.
Probably should say that. Would that be constitutional?
I believe so.
All right. Gentlemen, it's getting late in the hour. We have some work to do before the session.
Mr. Chairman, sure. I have a request to make. I would be very interested in a comparison of the substantive provisions of this bill with the parallel substantive provisions of the legislative statute with respect to what one can and cannot do.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator?
I would be interested in seeing that also. What you have to keep in mind, of course, we went through this before, is that the legislature is considered a part-time
job,
making your living outside of the process, where public employment is considered pretty much a full-time position.
Right.
Now, if I can make a recommendation, Senator Fisher and I went through this bill, 3 years ago, maybe, and it gets real complex. It takes a lot of time, and you're going to have a lot of people coming in screaming. and you're going to have a bunch of state employees coming in, giving hypothetical situations why this just can't work, and nobody works for the state anymore, you know, and this. So what I'm telling you is that this is a major piece of legislation that's going to take a lot of our time.
I understand.
And we're going to, and we're not going to be able to do it, I don't think, in our regular time meeting.
I understand. What other suggestions do you have, then, in additional time meetings?
I'll make myself available to your call.
Golly, there are two people that if we'd had commissions like this set up years ago, perhaps the world had been different. It seems like Christ was right, and look what they did to him. And Joan of Arc, they burned her at the stake. Maybe that wouldn't have happened if we'd have had this. Or maybe it would. Any further to come before the committee?
The easiest thing for the legislature to do would be to just pass this thing as written and let the poor 16,000 state employees die.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just say one thing. That's one of the reasons why Susan Cox and I are going department to department. We've had about 8 meetings now in a real attempt to educate the, particularly the division directors and above, about the provisions of this bill. And have asked them to coordinate their concerns through us as opposed to dragging you all into this.
Let's start fight. Here. Do you right now have any changes in mind before we begin looking at the bill?
There's only one change, one specific change in mind that has to do with the gifts and benefits section, and other than that, no, we don't. Most of the other provisions have...
What kind of responses have you received? Are people worried? Are they upset?
No, actually not. They have one. They do have some complaints about the reporting of gifts and things of that nature, but again, that's probably the only really major complaint. I think most of them agree with the provisions and don't find them overly onerous. There was some initial reaction about the post-employment provisions, but when we explain it to them and they see how narrowly they're construed, that's also popped up. And that's the reason we are doing this. We're doing it the rest of this weekend and next week as well in Anchorage, with an attempt to clarify to those people what the provisions are so that you're not swamped with complaints from executive branch officials about this bill.
What is the committee, what course of action does the committee really want to take on this from here in? Do we just want to have another meeting and then continue the overview? How do you want to approach this?
Mr. Chairman, it might be almost as well to start just hold some public hearings and let people scream and raise problems if there are any, and then get down to basics. I'll try to do some homework and
do we have any of that old material around?
My staff dug it out and gave it all to Senator Fakes for the procurement committee. I'm sure your committee can get it all back.
You realize, of course, they're trying to do this by pass it during this particular session so that it can go into effect on July of 86, I guess, something similar.
It would have been nice if they'd introduced it last year.
It would have been realized.
They were going to do.
Yeah. Now, the legislature can't be held responsible for that, and it isn't our fault that we might not get it passed.
Sure. I would like to point out that this bill is not based on, it's somewhat different in form from Senate Bill 501, the one that you all had worked on 2 years ago. We went back to ground zero and looked at all the state's legislation in this area and tried to come up with something that we thought was workable.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that we request the executive branch to look at ways of reducing the fiscal note drastically. I think the trend is just
okay.
Also, Randall, is this bill moving in the House now?
No, it's only been introduced on the Senate side.
Well, we can pass it and send it to the House.
And let them know.
Come out.
Is there anything? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
We are down to
taking attendance. We will reschedule at a later time. And the bill will be held. Anything further to come before the committee? Sure.
I think 10 minutes.